Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Maggs. Coming up on the program today, SAA is rocked by a leadership exit just as its turnaround story faces a new credibility test. Global supply chains are exposed as Dubai dependency turns from strength to risk. AI supercharges cybercrime, leaving companies scrambling to keep up. And rising fuel prices force South Africans to rethink how they buy and finance their cars. It's Monday, the 13th of April. Now, the turbulence at South African Airways, I think is fair to say, is sharply back in focus following the sudden resignation of its chief executive officer, John Lamola. And I think that raises fresh questions about leadership stability, about strategy, and whether the national carrier is actually on a sustainable flight path. After years of bailouts, restructuring, and promises of a turnaround, is SAA finally fixed? Or, as this might all suggest, are there deeper structural problems that still remain unresolved? Someone who's watching that closely is Dr. Joachim Vermeulen, who is a transport economist. Dr. Vermeulen, welcome back to the program and thank you. In your opinion, what does the resignation tell us then about the state of SAA right now?
Well, it seems to be very unstable at the moment. Unfortunately, not a lot has been published, but it reflects some serious disagreement on policy or direction or funding.
And it raises the questions around whether past reported profits are actually real, or are they just effectively a function of past taxpayer support and maybe some interesting accounting treatment?
Yeah. Well, fundamentally, I think they complied to the IFRS rules. But if you look at the normality of earnings and the ability to carry that forward, that is certainly under question. Whilst it may not be a difficulty with regard to reporting standards, if you look at the sustainability of the profits, it certainly is a problem.
Let's also reference operational sustainability. Doctor, if planes, as we read, their planes are flying below optimal load factors, in other words, they're not 100% full, that also says something surely about the airline's pricing power, and that would raise questions surely about long-term viability.
Yes, I think if one looks at the load factor, for example, as a metric, in the older days, about 68% load factor was seen as a normal trigger to actually add capacity. Today, your average load factor is much larger or higher. It's about 82% in order to break even. So you really need to operate your aircraft very, very full and for marketing and sales team that actually can achieve that result. So there's not a lot of opportunity to fly, with inadequate load factors. If you have persistent low load factors, you need to revisit your whole plan, your network strategy, your routes that you operate, and the equipment that you operate it with. If it's a too large aircraft with too many seats, you will. There's a sort of a optimum level of occupancy that you can achieve, and if that results into persistent low load factors, you need to reevaluate the size of aircraft that you fly. The size of aircraft is more important than the make of it, because most of the aircraft are, within a reasonable standard, competitive with one another, but it's really the sizing of it that's a crucial issue. The second issue is, of course, the average use of the aircraft, whether that's within the standards achieved by the market. You know, if you operate lower average utilization, then you will make losses. If you operate higher than that, you will be profitable. So that's the crucial metrics to look at.
Questions as well, Doctor, around whether the regional route network is working. So operating in South Africa, principally Johannesburg-Cape Town, Johannesburg-Durban, there are other ancillary routes as well. But a lot of regional routes that the aircraft or the airline is covering. Are there questions around whether those particular routes, in other words, into Africa, are sustainable and profitable, do you think?
I think the African routes have great potential, to be honest. The margins are higher, but the cost rates are lower. But the crucial issue, you shouldn't operate it with too large equipment. You know, you should have suitable equipment that's in size within the range that are generally used on those type of routes.
And you compare that, for instance, to an Airlink that is covering the same kind of routes, and they would be operating maybe smaller, more fuel-efficient aircraft.
That's correct, yes.
Let's talk about the boardroom itself, this continued leadership instability that we're seeing at SAA, although in fairness to Professor Lamola, he has been there for a while. Do you think it points to deeper governance risks that maybe undermine a bigger, more successful turnaround strategy?
Well, I think he's done a great job in actually restarting it. You know, the ultimate issue is fundamental issue on SAA. If you want to grow your routes, then you need a capital base. You know, most large type of institutions, like banks and financial institutions, you have to have a capital base that's broadly in some way in the relationship with your turnover or your activity level. So SAA has always been in a difficulty that the demand for in the scope and scale of operations is far larger than its capital base. So that's a fundamental issue that has been a difficulty. And of course, if you grow a network, it's like a new business. Every route is like a little new business, and you incur startup losses. The only thing is those losses are, you know, very cash hungry. So you need to have a pot of money, physical cash, to sustain you in your growing phase. Most airlines actually limit the growth that they can actually achieve by some sort of a relationship to between dividends or depreciation or profitability to see what is the extent to which they can grow. But that's been a difficulty for SAA over a long time, that it has not had the capital base to actually support the large levels of growth. The other thing is, of course, that unfortunately it has not been able to stabilize its financial and accounting records, which is really basic. And I think that is expected by every larger type of organization to apply accounting standards and governance standards, you know, which ultimately runs into qualifications by the Auditor General, which SAA has many issues.
You know. And Dr. Vermorten, to that point then, we would need to interrogate perhaps more clearly the role that government is still playing behind the scenes and whether that's helping or hindering. We know, for instance, that the airline issued new shares to the government, its sole shareholder, as part of a restructuring and recapitalization process in, if I remember correctly, the 2024-25 financial year. And that in itself has raised all sorts of issues about governance.
Yeah, one has to remember it dates back a little bit further, I think, to 22-23 in that vicinity, where a government actually gave SAA, through an appropriation bill, I think 1.8 billion. This is just a reallocation of that amount of money in physical shares. So instead of it lying there as a loan account or a shareholder contribution, it's now been firmed up into shares. So it's not new money, it's actually old money, but the nature of it has actually changed.
I'm going to leave it there. Dr. Joachim Vermeulen, transport economist. As always, I do appreciate the insight and the analysis. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
The fallout from the Middle East conflict is now rippling through global supply chains and is exposing just how dependent many multinationals have become on a handful of highly concentrated hubs like Dubai, for instance. What was once seen as a model of efficiency is now looking like a single point of failure, with rerouting, rising costs and operational risk all back on the table. Joining me now is Andre Scholler, who is Vice President and Head of Region India, Turkey and EMEA at the Global Logistics Network ZF Aftermarket. And I want to talk about whether this is a short-term disruption or a fundamental reset possibly in how global logistics is being restructured. Andre, a very warm welcome to you. And do you think companies have maybe in the immediate past become too complacent about relying on hubs like Dubai?
Well, thanks for having me, Jeremy. Well, I think that's the million-dollar question. I think the business model of Dubai has proven to be a very successful one. And Dubai itself, not being very dependent on oil, has made his own business model together with logistic a very successful one. And now with the situation, the question arises, obviously, is that sustainable, or is it because it's disrupted at the moment, how quickly and how strongly will Dubai be able to come back? Looking at the potential of Dubai and looking at the model that they have, I still have very high hopes in Dubai coming back.
It's all a question of timing, though, Andre, and as you rightly point out, we just don't know at this point whether it's a temporary disruption or possibly, and more concerningly, whether it's a structural shift in global supply chains. But again, probably too early to discern that.
Correct. But what we can say and what we can see is that, and I'm trying to paint that picture a bit from my regional responsibility and not necessarily only from a global point of view. But if you look at the aftermarket demand that we have in the region of the Middle East, the demand is strong. The car park is quite strong and quite significant. So from a demand point of view, the region will play a role. The question is rather, will that gate into the Middle East, which Dubai was, be sustainable or not? Or will there be other gates that are opening? But I do not have a slight doubt that the Middle East itself will remain a very important business area.
I want to talk about the impact on African markets in just a moment, but do you think we globally are already seeing cost pressure feeding through to business and consumers?
Well, we do see cost pressure partially. Especially on when we look at lubricants, for example, because you look at the oil price and you look at some other materials like aluminium or something like that. So you see an impact on prices of these raw materials, and that will obviously also affect the parts pricing and the prices on the materials that are shipped. That is visible. The rest so far is logistics.
How exposed, Andre, do you think African markets then are to this kind of disruption?
Well, they are affected because the African market, especially if you look at the East African countries, they are very closely linked to the Middle East and especially to the harbor in Dubai. So there is an exposure, but it's not the only lifeline that the African continent has, which is a good news. At the end of the day, it also gives Africa a certain flexibility on probably developing other hubs and other connections.
Well, let me talk about that. And it's not the first time that this conversation has happened, certainly in South Africa. But do you think this country is in a position to maybe develop itself as an alternative regional hub?
Well, I certainly hope so for South Africa. I mean, if you look at our location in South Africa, or our hopes that we have for South Africa. I mean, our company is as ZF, we are counting on that. Actually, we try to establish a regional hub concept that also includes South Africa as a center of gravity. So if it could turn out as a facilitator, it would help us a lot, because the potential in South Africa, and not only in South Africa, but also in the role of South Africa as a center of gravity also for the surrounding markets and for the whole continent, the potential is there. And I'm counting on that potential.
Of course, all contingent on whether Transnet, the state ports and logistics company, can improve its operational efficiency.
Obviously. And not only in South Africa, as I mentioned, but also South Africa, compared to many other surrounding markets, has a better stability when it comes to doing business. It depends a bit on the stability development of the surrounding markets as well. If the complete Southern African region might develop into such a hub. But I think the potential and the opportunity definitely is there. And probably now also the hunger for the nations involved, seeing that they need to be a bit more independent from the Middle East than they used to be in the last couple of years.
How difficult is it for companies to reroute their supply chains, though, even if we do see the emergence of decentralized logistics networks?
I think it's not too difficult. What is always difficult is to build up and build down facilities. Rerouting supply chain is not difficult. It's a question of cost, obviously, in the beginning, I would see. But just rerouting is not the main issue.
I'm going to leave it there. André Scholler, thank you very much indeed from ZF Aftermarket. I appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, artificial intelligence, I don't need to tell you, is rapidly reshaping the cybersecurity landscape. We have focused on this in the past, not necessarily on the defensive side, but increasingly in the hands of attackers. And that's the worrying aspect, with new tools capable of identifying vulnerabilities and then launching sophisticated attacks at unprecedented speeds. And I guess the concern is that what was once the domain of elite hackers is now becoming accessible at scale. I want to discuss this in a little more detail with Hendrik De Bruin, who's head of security consulting at Checkpoint Technologies, and let's assess whether companies are keeping up or already falling behind. Hendrik, welcome, and this is such an important issue. Do you think that AI has tipped the balance now in favor of attackers?
Good day, Jeremy. Thank you very much for having me today, and good day to your audience also. Yes, some important points that you mentioned there, Jeremy. Indeed, we see that AI, and more specifically the rumors around the latest version, Claude Mythos, does indeed have a very large impact on cybersecurity and the industry as a whole. So what we have really found is that essentially these modern AI models mean the death of the artisan hack. So traditionally, attacking cybersecurity infrastructure, etc., meant that you have to have a lot of knowledge around cybersecurity, the systems itself, technology, and so forth. And traditionally, it was a very manual type of exercise. We may have had some tools that we were able to leverage to firstly identify vulnerabilities, from there exploit them, etc. But it was very much dependent on knowledge, where now with artificial intelligence, we see that attackers can automatically start to find vulnerabilities and even exploit these vulnerabilities, leading to multi-step attack automation. And that obviously leaves the entire world and organizations vulnerable to the capabilities that we now find within artificial intelligence and how it is being weaponized by attackers.
Hendrik, very quickly, tell us about this Claude Mythos, if you can.
Yes. So Claude Mythos is currently essentially, it's in a preview state at the moment, and they are essentially keeping it in a preview state because of the potential impact that it may have in terms of cybersecurity risk. So it was found that this model has significant capabilities in, as I mentioned, firstly identifying vulnerabilities in existing software, existing vulnerabilities and new vulnerabilities, but also having the ability to automate the exploitation. And, that is the real impact. Now, as it stands, as I mentioned, Claude, Mythos have significant enhanced abilities in doing this. And that is why at the moment, Anthropic is actually holding back onto this model, providing some cybersecurity organizations a preview to firstly, harden their own code, etc., and also see how they can leverage this technology in defending our customers, in assisting them with taking a prevention first stance.
And it's worrying because when it is eventually launched, it'll be the Wild West out there.
Indeed. And that is why your organizations should now start to look at how they can adopt architecture and security controls that allow them to identify these risks proactively, right? Before an attacker has the ability to exploit these risks or to make use of artificial intelligence to automate and exploit these risks, it is important for organizations to identify them proactively and allow organizations the time to mitigate those risks, in time for these models and their new capabilities.
What about traditional cyber defenses? Are you telling me they're just no longer fit for purpose?
Indeed. The traditional way of having a reactive cyber security approach where, we only sort of detect the threat when it is already in your environment has essentially become obsolete. We find that even traditional cybersecurity threats like malware is now adopting artificial intelligence to for evasion purposes. So what we have found is, some of these new malware strains, what they use in terms of artificial intelligence is to, on a continuous basis, essentially alter and amend its own code base. And what that means, every time it changes its own code, it essentially becomes a new malware strain. And where a lot of traditional cybersecurity tools and defenses rely on what is called file signatures in order to detect things like malware, those mechanisms have all essentially become redundant. And we now need to take into consideration what is termed the non-deterministic nature of threats as it is introduced by artificial intelligence.
How exposed do you think South African businesses are specifically?
South African businesses, like the rest of the world, are significantly exposed. What we actually find in terms of statistics is that currently we find that African businesses are actually under attack more often than the global average. And part of the key reasons behind that is that Africa has really gone on this digital adoption drive, digitizing our existing paper-based processes and the likes. And every time we go on this digitization drive, we are also essentially expanding our digital attack surface. We're exposing, adopting new technologies, often exposed onto the internet. And those technologies, if we don't actively look for risks inside those technologies, attackers may have the opportunity to exploit them. So very much South African as well as African businesses are very much exposed and at risk to this.
Is there anything differently the chief executive should be doing, not just the IT teams?
Yes, indeed. The business executives should understand the real impact that cyber attacks have on businesses. It's no longer a information technology concern. It is a business concern because these cyber attacks lead to downtime, which leads to loss in revenues. It leads to reputational harm, oftentimes that organizations can't even recover from. So it is imperative that we don't look at these risks just as a technology issue, just as an IT issue. It is a business risk, and it's a business issue that needs to be addressed.
Well, we can't say we haven't been warned. Hendrik De Bruin, thank you very much indeed, Head of Security Consulting at Checkpoint Technologies.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, fuel prices are surging again, driven by global oil volatility, geopolitical tension, and a weaker rand. And while the immediate pain is at the pump, the deeper shift is in how South Africans are now starting to think about car ownership itself. Fuel is no longer just a running cost. I think it's becoming central to affordability decisions, financing choices, and whether, in fact, consumers buy at all. So let's put that under the microscope. I'm in conversation now with Robert Gwarengwe, who's Chief Executive Officer of WesBank. Robert, always good to talk to you, and thank you so much for joining us. Are we seeing a real behavioral shift just yet, or is it still too early to see any signals within that data?
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. Always enjoy being here. So we're starting to see a shift. I think it hasn't been that long that the war has been going on, but the impact has already been dire. I mean, if you look at the price increase announced in the last week, it's a material impact on consumers. And what we are starting to see is a shift towards sort of a little bit more hybrid vehicles, slightly smaller engines, as opposed to, I guess, 6 months ago, where the expectations were lower inflation, more affordability, and the fuel price wasn't as big a deal at the time. So that's certainly coming in as we see it.
So when South Africans actually walk into a dealership onto the showroom floor, you're saying that their behavior is noticeably changing, apart from the look of worry on their face, I guess.
Absolutely. So the behavior is changing. We also run a series as WesBank around the total cost of ownership. And we're seeing that we're getting more hits on that. So more people are actually more worried about the actual total cost of ownership, whereas in the past, the biggest worry was the monthly installment and is their service plan. Now it's, okay, what are the other elements? And fuel has become a significant part of that.
Well, let's talk a little bit more in detail about that to help me understand what the other components are of total cost of ownership. And in practical terms then, Robert, what does that mean for the average consumer?
So for when we talk total cost of ownership, there's generally your monthly installment that you pay whoever's financing the vehicle, insurance, which people often underestimate the cost of, the maintenance of the vehicle, whether it's covered by service plan or not, and if it does break down, can you afford to fix it? And there's obviously the fuel that you need to put in there. So if you went and you bought a relatively well-priced 5-liter V12 a vehicle, you probably are paying more for fuel than you are for the actual car. So it's looking at the holistic picture as opposed to just some elements of it. And as the fuel prices have gone up, that piece has become a bigger and bigger chunk of total cost of ownership for our customers.
So that 5-liter vehicle, let's park that to one side of the showroom if we can. You did say to me that buyers are starting to trade down slightly, looking at more efficient vehicles, hybrid vehicles, smaller vehicles. But I would imagine the concern as well for the sector as a whole is simply delaying purchase.
There is that concern. There's delaying purchase. And there's also, I mean, with the war going on, the fuel prices, the volatility, naturally, lenders will pull back. So fewer customers will qualify because we don't know if inflation is going to go through the roof. So if you let too many customers in where affordability is a bit tight, they might not be able to afford it in the next 6 months, which is a position you don't want to put customers into. So I think all of those factors lead to uncertainty, and it's either the downgrade or let's wait and see what happens in the next couple of months and make a decision then.
Do you think that calculus is applying both to used and new vehicles?
I think it would apply to both. Again, it is quite fresh. If you look at quarter on quarter, this first quarter of this year versus first quarter of last year, sales are up 12%. Of new vehicles. So the buoyancy in the market that came through at the end of last year continued. But with the volatility now being brought in by the war, we expect those numbers to start to taper a little bit while there is the wait and see. And that's both on new and used vehicles. And the phenomenon between new and used, I mean, you know, Jeremy, that the proportion of new has sort of taken over some of the used market because of the value being offered by some of the brands from the East.
How then are banks such as yours, Robert, adjusting? Are you changing your risk modeling or your lending criteria in response?
So nothing drastic. We don't believe, our philosophy is to be always on and try and help as many individuals and businesses as we possibly can, because we think our responsibility goes beyond just what a traditional lender speaks about, but really about enabling mobility, enabling SMMEs, enabling businesses. So we need to play our part. But given that we expect inflation to start to tick up, we expect the drop in interest rates to be delayed at best, we've just taken the prudent view to trim at the edges while we wait and see what the actual outcome will be. I mean, we've seen there's a 2 week ceasefire. We hope it lasts beyond that and that brings some normalcy back and we can go back to things as they were. But we do need to be prudent as we move forward.
When you say trim at the edges, that sounds very vague. What does that actually mean?
So we have from a risk criteria customers that perhaps towards the end of last year, given the outlook was so positive and that we were seeing increased affordability come into the market, we probably approved another 2 or 3% of customers we previously weren't approving, and it's likely we are not like we are going to for the next little while go back to the old policy where we cut back there. Because I think if we don't, and inflation hits the numbers we think it may if the war continues, then we would have put those customers in a bad position.
Which tells me that we could be moving towards a future where car ownership becomes less accessible for the average South African if the current status quo remains.
I think in its traditional sense, that is true if you just look at the market dynamics. Our challenge as Westbank is to look at this as mobility as a whole and start looking at, I guess, how our customers move from point A to B, move their goods from point A to B, as opposed to having to own the vehicle. Because if we continue to work in the same model, I do think when events like this happen, it becomes problematic. But so we're looking at different solutions to ensure we can still help, but differently.
But fair to say, though, that if fuel prices stay elevated, and there's every likelihood that they will, at least in the short to medium term, it could permanently change the structure of the vehicle market in South Africa, right?
I think so. I think it could. I think you get an increase in hybrids and more people will be more amenable to driving electric vehicles and taking the range anxiety into account and in their minds taking that risk on it. I do think vehicle sales will continue. I just think the structure of how that works and ownership will change. I think you have more leases, you have more shorter term deals, but people are still interested in mobility, and it is key.
Robert Gwerengwe is the Chief Executive Officer of Westbank. Thank you very much for talking to me. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.